It's a real honor. It really is. And I particularly want to thank Liz for nominating me. When she told me she was going to do it, I thought, oh, yeah, go ahead. It'll never happen. I should say much of my work in Flavor was inspired by Liz, and she was really a mentor early on in starting us out down the road, convinced us that it was a project that was really worth doing. So let me just start by saying that I have been very lucky. I think in this audience I can safely say I've been very lucky to have time in industry working at Monsanto. I think personally that developing transgenic technology and the things that we did when I was there are probably, it may have had as much impact on agriculture as did the Green Revolution. It's changed agriculture and the way farmers work. But to put it in context, it's really interesting. When I flying on an airplane, if I'm sitting next to someone working in agriculture, they treat me like royalty when I tell them that I've done that. But we actually have a house on the left coast that we vacation at, and when I go there, there's a coffee shop that's on an island that will remain nameless where our house is, and there's a big sign on the front door saying no GMOs with a big X through it. But you can buy a latte there made with raw milk. So that puts it in perspective. My wife always hits me on the side when we go in. She said, don't dare tell them what you do. So anyway, I feel like it was a really unique time. What we did at Monsanto was really special, but I can always put it in context just by going to California or Washington. So coming from industry originally, we had, when you do science in industry versus academia, you have to have a different time frame. And so I actually started working on tomatoes while there. We were working on hormones, and we started working on ethylene. We worked on the mechanism of synthesis and did some work to help to characterize ethylene receptors. We had an idea that was very simple, and we said, well, you know, all those farmers down in Florida are picking these tomatoes when they're green so that they can ship them long distances. And what if we were to come up with a technology that extended shelf life and allowed us to let them ripen further on the vine? Maybe they'd taste better. And so that was our initial foray into tomato flavor. And we actually developed some really cool technology. It's shown here. It's a bacterial enzyme that prevents ethylene synthesis. And what you get is you get tomatoes with extremely long shelf lives, and you can pick them later, and they do taste better if you do that. But it failed, and it failed for one very simple reason, and that was that we were trying to do it at the time that the public perception turned against GMOs in Europe and to some extent in the U.S., and so it was never commercialized. So about that time, I had the opportunity to move to the University of Florida to take an endowed chair, and I jumped at it. And they wanted someone to come and work on tomatoes. And so we were working on ethylene and working on the basic biology of how fruit ripens, what makes them ripen, what happens during ripening. And then in large part, due to interactions with Liz, among others, we started saying, well, you know, we don't have to worry about shareholders. We can do some science that really will take us a long time and that can really make a difference. And so we said, well, let's not work on these indirect methods. Let's work on the direct method. Let's understand what flavor is, and let's try and fix it. So that was 15 years ago or so that we started this project, and I think you'll see that we've made a lot of progress. We're very close, and it's taken a long time and some unexpected turns. But let's talk about the flavor problem. Everybody, I'm sure, in this room, unless there is a couple of tomato breeders sitting here, everyone will admit that the quality of the commercial, particularly field-grown tomato, is really pretty lousy. It's the major source of complaints in the produce aisle for consumers. They're extremely disappointed with flavor. And that has some real consequences. The Florida tomato industry is suffering because they produce a product that people don't want. And so our challenge is, can we fix that? Now, I have to be very careful whenever I meet the head of the Florida Tomato Committee. I say, it's not the grower's fault. It's the system's fault. And the fault here is that growers are not paid for flavor. Now, there are exceptions. You have things like the Campari tomato and a few niche markets. But for the most part, the growers, the industrial growers, are not paid for flavor. They're paid for how many pounds of red objects they put in a box. And the problem is that consumers don't like them. And the growers are not paid a premium to produce something that the consumer likes. Now, the fact is, if there's any fans of Alice Waters in the audience, you can block your ears, but most Americans are not fond of the idea of eating locally and eating what's in season. They want to eat food that tastes really good, and that's the underlying principle, of course, to what Alice Waters is driven by in her cooking. But the reality is most Americans don't buy that way. They want to buy the product when they want it, right now, and they want it to taste good. And so we have a problem. We have a huge problem where the industrial tomato, and the tomato is just the poster child. There's lots of other examples of this, but people are wanting a tomato year-round, and they don't want to pay very much money for it, but they expect it to taste good. And that has some real serious consequences. People don't like it, and they don't purchase it as a result. Now, the other challenge in all of this, the reason it's taken us 15 years to get to where we are, is flavor's really complicated, and we'll go into that. It's not like a disease resistance where you've got a single allele on chromosome 6 that makes it taste good. You have to understand the chemistry of flavor. You have to understand that this is many different compounds that are integrating into a package that gives you tomato flavor. So it's a very complex genetics. It's taken us a long time to understand it. The breeders have not deliberately set out to make tomatoes that taste like cardboard. It's just that they've gotten there because they have not been able to select for good flavor. So we hope to fix that. The thing that really drives us, I think, is that flavor and nutrition are really one and the same. People, again, now I'll insult another well-known writer, a guy named Mark Bittman. If you've ever read him, he writes for the New York Times. He's a moron, so if you don't know who he is, don't look up. People buy things that taste good. We eat bad foods because they taste good. People eat at McDonald's because they like it, and it's cheap. What we have to do is we have to make good foods taste better so that people will make more intelligent decisions about their diets. And that's what it's all about. It's making really good tomatoes, strawberries, whatever, that people really want to buy and eat. So that's what we're about. So this is a program that we started a few years ago, and it started in an interesting way. For those of you in academia, particularly if there are any administrators in the audience, this was the best thing an administrator ever did for us. My colleague David Clark, who many of you will know, and I were asked to go to a meeting by our at the time BP, and he said, there's this lady who's a psychologist, and I think she can really help you, and you've got a lot in common, and you should talk to her. And so we sat in this room, and Linda Bartoshuk is the person. Linda's kind of a crotchety old lady, and she says, I don't even know why I'm here. Why am I here? What do you do? And we started talking, and all of a sudden, we really hit it off, and we realized that we could do some really interesting stuff together. It's interdisciplinary science, and this was the start of what's now officially, as of a few months ago, the Plant Innovation Center. So Dave is the director of the new center, but what we do approaches some really complicated problems in some very interdisciplinary ways, and I think that there are people in the room who are members of this center, and I'd be happy to talk with you more about it afterwards. the word that Linda uses is psychophysics. Linda is an expert. She's a psychologist. She's also an expert on flavor and taste. She's the first person who coined the word super tasters. She understands flavor and smell in ways that that other people don't. And the term that she uses is psychophysics. And basically, as it says right there, what it does is it takes what we put in front of people and measures quantitatively how they respond to it and how much they'll pay for it. So this is a very powerful link up for us, because we can begin to use Linda's tools to understand what people like and what they want to buy. So it's a very logical process. We start out, unlike most breeding programs, we start out with the consumer. We say, what do you want? What do you like? What things drive you to want to buy this product? We do sensory analysis. So where I fit in is we get the sensory analysis, and you'll see how I fit in, but we take the products that they're eating apart, and we say, what's in them? And then we say, well, what's in them, what's really important to actually driving consumer preferences and liking? And then we say, okay, these are the chemicals that we really care about that contribute to flavor, and then we say, how does the plant make them? And we work all the way down to the genetics, and then we work with the breeders to say, these are the traits that you want to be working on, these are the specific chemicals that are driving liking, and this is the genetics behind them. And then that gets introduced into the elite germplasm, and we work right back to the consumer. So it's a cycle. It takes a long time to build this. We built it in tomato, we built it in blueberry and strawberry, and you may have heard some of the talks already at this meeting about that. But that's the concept. And believe it or not, it's unique. Dave Clark likes to say, when he talks about it, ornamental breeding, he says, the problem with ornamental breeding, and this is very illustrative, he says, 90% of the people who buy flowers are women. 90% of the breeders are men. It's really important that we understand the target. And in this case, the target is you. It's what do you like and what's going to make you buy that tomato. So let's talk about flavor. Flavor in tomato is complicated. I've simplified it down to three classes of chemicals here: sugar, acids, and volatiles. Sugars are easy. You have to have a certain level of sugar, and honestly, probably many of you in this room, the sweeter it is, the better you'll like the tomato. You have to have sugar. You have to have acids to balance that sugar. Citrate and malate are the predominant acids in tomato. But volatiles are where we've really focused a lot of our effort. And there's a really good reason for that. The reason is because most of flavor is volatile chemicals. When we think of taste, don't get taste and flavor confused. Taste are the molecules that you recognize in your mouth: sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. There's only five basic taste flavors. Well, you know that there's a whole lot more than five different flavors that you experience in your life. All of that flavor is coming from the volatiles. So the volatiles, what happens is that when you put something in your mouth, you chew it, and air, when you swallow, is forced up through the back of your mouth and reaches your olfactory epithelium, where it's detected. That's what gives us the flavor. It's really important for flavor. I tell people, and this is true, that the olfactory receptor gene family is the largest gene family in the human genome. That tells you a whole lot about how important smell is to you. Now, there's a reason that we focus on that in addition, and that is, in the end, I have to go back to the grower and say, will you grow these varieties? And the first question he or she is going to ask is, what's the yield? And so we have that huge barrier, and honestly, we still are fighting to cross that barrier. But the thing about the volatiles is they're really active. Sugars and acids are active biologically at the millimolar level. Volatile chemicals are active at the picomolar or nanomolar level. What that means is that I can make push big increases in the volatile chemicals to enhance flavor and hopefully not have much of a yield penalty. Growers have breeders have focused on sugars for many years because it's easy to measure and because they know it's important to flavor. So growers, I'm not going to come up with much more in the area of sugar because it's really been focused on. Volatiles have been completely neglected. Actually, not completely neglected. Liz has worked on them for years. Liz and I are the only people who really appreciate volatiles. In tomato, anyway. So I'm going to show you a list here, and I'm going to make a couple of points. This is a list that came up with one of the probably one of the pioneers in flavor, and particularly in tomato, again, another USDA scientist, Ron Buttery. Unfortunately, Ron didn't have Linda Bartoshuk leaning over his shoulder telling him how wrong he was about all everything that he thought. This was a list that was put together of the important odor volatiles, and it was based on a concept called odor units. That is, how sensitive are we to the compound and how much of it is there? If it's higher than the threshold, then it must contribute to flavor. The problem is that that's a simplified version. Many of these compounds are important, but some of them are not. I won't go into the reasons, but it's more complicated than just how much of it is there and can I smell it. The other interesting point that I want to make is on the right side, and that is that all of the precursors of all of these volatiles are essential components of the human diet. Well, that's really interesting because what it's telling us is that the things that we smell, the things that we respond to, are linked to nutrients, essential amino acids, essential fatty acids, or carotenoids that are the precursors of vitamin A. We like what's good for us. And that's real to me, it's really interesting that we like the things that signal that they're precursors, that the precursors of these compounds are essential, we need it, we should eat it. Okay, so how do we do this? We've gone through it very logically, and you'll see that in the last year, actually a lot of what we did has been superseded with new technologies, but I'll walk you through it. We define the most important volatiles and sugars and acids that drive consumer preferences. We define the pathways for the synthesis of those compounds. We define the rate-limiting steps. What's limiting to the plant making more of those chemicals? We identify the genes and then the alleles of those genes that are most desirable, and we put them back into the plant. So very simple, except not really. So how do we do that? We've exploited tomato germplasm, and tomato germplasm is really wonderful. Even though it's been through basically three domestication bottlenecks, there's still a tremendous amount of variation within tomatoes. We've gone back and we work primarily with heirloom tomatoes. We've tracked down a lot of seeds. A lot of people have sent us seeds of their favorite varieties. We have some, the earliest ones that we can document go back to 1870. So before that third bottleneck of the really intensive breeding programs of the post-World War II era, there is amazing variation. Anybody who's ever grown the heirloom tomatoes knows that there's some just amazing differences in the flavors. So we're capitalizing on those differences to understand flavor. If you look, there's just tremendous variation within the species, within those heirloom varieties for the volatiles that we're interested. In some cases, thousands of fold between different heirloom varieties. Well, that means a couple of things. First of all, I should tell you, the modern varieties, not surprisingly, are at the lower end. If you grow the modern commercial tomatoes, you'll see that they're at the lower end of the range for sugars, acids, and almost all of those volatiles. But it tells us that we can use the existing germplasm as a resource to recapture flavor. So we can go back to the early 1900s, the late 1800s, and we can rescue the alleles that will push those chemicals back up to where they should be. So I'm gonna, I know that I'll get asked this question, so I will tell you that when I say the perfect tomato, I'm talking about an average. It's an average of 100 consumers. With Linda's technologies, we've been able to break it down. We understand that there are differences in the population. We understand that foodies like different tomatoes than non-foodies. We understand that older people like different tomatoes than younger people. We also know that there are ethnic and cultural differences. Having said that, we can use this average to make a tomato that's really good. All of you would agree that this is a really good tomato. It might not be your absolute favorite, but it might. But everybody is going to agree that the tomato that comes out of these studies is going to be a really good tomato. So what we did is we quantified 68 different chemicals in about 200 varieties. We're probably closer to 300 by now. We've taken a subset of those that really cover the range of chemical differences, and we give them to a 100-person consumer panel. And we ask them a lot of questions about how much do you like it, how sweet do you think it is. We ask them many questions about those tomatoes, and we end up with what essentially is a model. And so what we do is we use statistics to tease out what of those chemicals really correlates with whether someone likes that tomato or not. And we can optimize it. We can use the statistics to basically come up with a recipe. You want this much of chemical A, that much of chemical B, and that will give you an ideal tomato. The interesting thing that I won't talk about is we can actually use it as a predictive model. We can take any tomato, and with reasonable accuracy, we can define how much you're going to like it before you taste it. It's a little more complicated because you have to work in color and you have to work in texture. But we can in large part do that. Anyway, we come up with a model of the chemical composition that's ideal. And the nice thing is we can test that model. And we have tested it with mutants that are blocked in specific pathways and also in transgenic that knock out specific pathways. So we can go in and we can, to some extent, validate the model. And everything that we've done so far says the model's pretty good. It tells us what the target is. So that's the important thing. We've defined the target. So some of the results that we've gotten out, some of the most abundant volatiles do not contribute to liking. You can tell that they're there. If we remove them, you can tell me that this tomato is different than this other tomato, but you don't care. So that's where you start to go back to that original list. Yes, you can use that original odor unit list to say, can I detect it? And the answer is yes. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's forcing you or influencing you in any way to like or dislike that tomato. So we can focus on a subset of those 400 volatiles that we can actually detect in a tomato and get it down to a list of about 25 that really, really are important for flavor. Some of the rare volatiles, particularly the ones derived from carotenoids, we're really sensitive to them. We can detect them in picomolar quantities, and they're very important for flavor, and I'll show you in a second why. The perception of sweetness is really good. If I show you a graph, in fact I will show you a graph, of perceived sweetness versus liking, you'll see a very good correlation. The thing that surprised us about all of this is that sugar is not the sole determinant of how sweet something tastes. And that was the really interesting fundamental discovery that came out of this. Specific volatile chemicals make significant contributions to how sweet you think something tastes. And I can show you that on the next slide. So this is a correlation of a bunch of the varieties that we put through our panels. And I've circled two tomatoes there. And what I'm showing you is the perceived sweetness on the y-axis versus how much sugar is in that tomato on the x-axis. And what you're going to see is there's a pretty good correlation, but there are some real outliers there. The yellow jelly bean actually has more sugar in it than that Matina, but people are telling us that on an objective scale, the Matina is twice as sweet as the yellow jelly bean. That's all coming from volatile chemicals. And we can show statistically that all of the ones that are above the gray line there are enriched in a specific subset of those volatiles, and all the ones below the other gray line are deficient in those volatiles. So we come up with a really interesting, totally unexpected result that says volatiles are working across modalities in your brain to enhance your perception of sweetness. This may or may not be learned. It may be innate. We don't really know. You could come up with a model in which you say, well, you eat something that's got a lot of sugar in it, you associate flavor, like think of eating an orange. The smell of the orange, you are always associating that with sugar. It probably then builds in a learning manner and enhances the perception of sweetness. You expect when you smell this that you're going to come across sugar. So just to summarize, we know which volatiles are really important, and we know about how much we want as targets. And almost all these chemicals, there is an optimum level, and then it does go down. So we know qualitatively and quantitatively what we want to do to the tomato. That was the easy part. So I'm going to show you a slide, and don't glaze. Your eyes will glaze over, and just take a deep breath. I'm only going to show it to you for a few seconds. How do we get at the important genes? We've spent a lot of time working out pathways. How are those compounds made? And everything in red on this is a volatile compound, and other people have done some of this too. This is not just our work. Don Grierson's lab has done some really nice stuff in this area too. But basically, all of those kind of brownish boxes are where we've discovered genes that are involved in the synthesis of these volatiles. The reason that I show you this is not so you'll remember what comes from what, but the fact that we can cluster them into pathways. And understanding the pathways was very helpful to us because of one very simple reason. When you've got 26 different compounds, when I go to a breeder and say, yeah, you've got to increase 26 compounds, they're going to laugh at me. They're going to say, yeah, right. Well, because we understand the pathways and because of some of the genetics that we've also done, we know that it's not that complicated because we could put them in classes. And I can, for example, single genes can influence all of the things that each of those circles. So you can see right off that I can get all but four of these compounds with basically five genes. When I go to a molecular breeder and say, I need you to put five genes in, they say, no problem. So we've reduced tremendously. So all of that work, and I should say this is probably the cumulative work of, I don't know, five postdocs and three graduate students maybe on one slide that I just flash right through. That knowledge was really useful to us because it allowed us to understand the pathways, understand the key bottlenecks in those pathways, and how we could affect them. So how do we get at the most important regulatory genes? Here we go back to genetics. Again, we're exploiting the genome, and we're exploiting the knowledge of the different species. So we're taking the tomato clade, and we're using it as a source for introducing genetics. So we're in this case, we're relying on some really nice work that was done by Steve Tanksley at Cornell and also by Dani Zamir at the Hebrew University, who've developed some really useful tools for us. And again, don't let your eyes glaze over. What you're looking at are the 12 chromosomes of tomato, and each of those red lines is an introgression line. So each of those red lines is one piece of a wild relative of tomato that's been introduced into the tomato, and everything else is the same. 76 of them cover the entire genome. So what we've done is we've grown these things up over many seasons. We quantify all of the chemicals, all the flavor chemicals that are in each of those varieties. And if one of them stands out as being different, we know that within that region, there's an interesting gene, something that's affecting a target chemical. You then just use standard genetics to go through, make recombinants, do mapping. We rely a lot on genomics tools. Our collaborator, Jim Giovannone, another USDA person, this was not intentional. It just so happens that we've had a lot of interactions with USDA people. Jim's lab has done a lot of work to interact. We've had a collaborative grant now that goes back a dozen years. We have very accurate maps of the tomato genome, what genes are where, and the levels of expression. We use that, all of that information, genes that are expressed in fruit, genes that are expressed differentially between introgression lines and controls. We've gotten a lot of genes. So this is just a quick map. Everything that you see on the right half with a little three-letter code is something that someone spent a lot of time trying to isolate and walk to and identify and validate that it's in fact the gene controlling a pathway. So we've made a tremendous amount of progress, and I want to just show you a couple of examples. Here are four different genetic loci that we mapped that all control phenylalanine-derived volatiles. These are really important. If you've ever worked on roses or smelled a rose, the predominant aroma is phenylethanol. That's this pathway. We were able to work out the pathway for its synthesis. We had four different loci that control, and when we superimpose that on what we know about the pathway, you'll see we learn a lot. The first enzyme in the pathway is an aromatic amino acid decarboxylase. Well, that's one of those QTLs. It tells us this is the major QTL in the pathway. If you affect the level of expression of this gene, you affect the levels of all of the downstream volatiles. The one on chromosome 12 is a rate-limiting step to one of the branches within the pathway. The one on chromosome 4 turns out to actually be an enzyme that's rate limiting to accumulation of phenylalanine itself, the precursor. So right off, we know that the genes we're isolating are really critical enzymes in the pathway. And in theory, we can even stack these and get more effects. So let me just show you where we're going with this. It turns out that esters are very important contributors to flavor, but actually in tomato, they're negative contributors. The more esters that are in the tomato, the less people like them. So we actually want to reduce the levels of esters. Well, it turns out that there's an enzyme on chromosome 1 that we mapped through this QTL mapping that's an esterase. It degrades esters, removes them from the tomato, so in theory it's going to make that tomato taste better. So we isolated the gene through a lot of work, got down, and we said, so can we understand anything that'll help us with this gene? So this just shows you what it does. It removes acetic acid from an ester and releases and makes a free volatile, which has a very different aroma profile. We found that in the tomato varieties, I forget how many there are, something like 24 or something in that range, we sequenced the gene from all of those and identified a polymorphism in the gene, and we see that it breaks out very nicely. There are two alleles. One of them corresponds to very high levels of ester, and one corresponds to low ester. So this is proof of principle. This is where we're going. We're saying, okay, this is an important gene. Can we identify an allele that will push the flavor profile more to where we want it? And the answer is yes. So don't worry about this slide. It's just a screen capture to remind me. So everything changed last year. I was at a meeting in China and met a guy there who was who said, well, you know, we've got really good cheap sequencing, and we'll gladly collaborate with you if you can promise that we'll get a paper into Science or Nature. For those of you who don't know, actually, there's a system in China where in many universities they get a bonus if they get published in very high journals. So like a paper in Science can be worth $100,000 to them personally. So there's a very strong motive to collaborate. anyway, he's a great collaborator. I'm just joking. He really is a really good... He has sequenced for us 300 complete genome sequences of our heirloom tomatoes. So we now have a massive database of that entire gene space that we've been working with all of these years. So now we're in a position where this changes everything. Now we're going back and scrambling, and we're going back to do the complete chemical profiling on everything that he's sequenced. And in fact, just last week, we went from 160 up to 275. So of the 300 that he sequenced, we've now phenotyped 275. Well, what that means is that we can use genome-wide association studies. So what that means is that we can look for now alleles that segregate with chemical composition. So again, in many ways, this changes everything because it opens up a wealth of possibilities for us. We go and he just tells us, there's an allele on this case on chromosome 6 that affects citric acid levels. And there's an allele on chromosome 9 that's correlated with guaiacol, one of our volatile chemicals. Well, we've done this now. It still is a work in progress, but all of a sudden, we have a whole set of alleles that affect major flavor chemicals. And I'll just show you this one slide that illustrates what the two different alleles can do. You can see that each of these are highly significant. We can affect sugar. We can affect citrate, malate, guaiacol. This is just a partial list, but and you can see that they're highly significantly different. We can really impact flavor from these alleles. So what it means is that we've now gotten to the point where this really is just a standard breeding protocol. I mean, it really is taking alleles, mapping them, and introgressing them as fast and efficiently as we can do it. And I think that that's going to be a real game changer. So that's where we are with the commercial tomato. We still have a lot of work to do. I see Sam, one of our collaborators in the back. He's a tomato breeder, but he's a good one. And we can work with people like him because he's more focused with the industry side. And we can introduce the desirable alleles into potentially elite varieties. And I think that we can have a real measurable outcome that will lead to better tasting tomatoes. But while we're doing that, I'm just going to end on a different, slightly different note. The commercial tomato is really hard. It's really hard because, again, the growers are really focused on yield. We really have to focus on giving them a tomato that tastes better, that does not compromise yield. That's a big, big challenge. And again, I hope that I've convinced you that we have some real powerful tools now to do that. In the meantime, we focus on you, the consumer. And we thought, well, what better way to get people who really care about tomatoes something than to work on home garden varieties? Now, the dirty little secret, again, of the industry is most of the commercial varieties that are sold, particularly the hybrids, are varieties that basically failed in commercial testing. So it's not nearly as high a barrier. Everybody knows that an heirloom tomato tastes great. Everybody knows that heirloom tomatoes are really hard to grow. They have very poor yield, and they have very poor disease resistance packages. So what we thought is, well, you know, we have this incredible knowledge base that we've built up of heirloom tomatoes, which ones taste really good and which ones don't, and how they perform. So what we did is we set out to make the best of both worlds. So we got several elites, some older elite varieties that had been around in Florida for several decades. We also got some from Jay Scott and Sam Hutton that were more modern, and we basically put together a matrix and looked for combining abilities and came down to a few combinations that really clicked. And so I'm going to show you one of them. Now, I must have been asleep when I put this slide together, but the heirloom is on the left and the hybrid is on the right. And actually, the heirloom fruit is on the right and the parent, the modern parent is on the left. But anyway, I think you can see that the yield, the vigor of the plant is dramatically improved in this hybrid. It turns out that in this case, this variety, the fruits are three times larger than the heirloom. However, when we put them through our taste panel, they taste actually just as good as the heirloom. The yield is three times greater than the heirloom. So we've got really the best of both worlds here. We've got a high-yielding variety that has all the flavor of the heirloom and most of the performance of the modern variety. So we released two of those, and they're one large, one small. The small one's fabulous. It makes a great marinara sauce as well. And people really like them. They have consistently come in at the top of our consumer panels. So we're waiting. A number of seed companies have expressed interest. We're in negotiations with one of them. But in the meantime, we were getting so many people contacting us saying, can I get your varieties? And I was starting to feel really, really guilty about this, saying no to everybody but my closest friends, and said, well, what can we do about this? So we worked together with the university and came up with something. So what we've done is we've put on my lab's webpage a link where people can go and make a $10 contribution to the research program, tax deductible, by the way, and we will send you two packages of 20 seeds each of the two varieties that we've released. Well, it turns out that since we did this a few months ago, we've had 1,400 people get on and make those donations. And I think the reason I show you this is because it just goes to show you how desperate people are for a tomato that really tastes good. And so, I mean, it makes us feel really good. It all goes to the research program, which honestly we don't make very much money because we have to pay someone to produce the hybrid seed. But the reality is that this just tells us that we're doing something that people really care about. And we're really happy with the response. So if anybody in the audience works for an heirloom seed company, you're going to see your sales drop in the next year. And if you're sitting there going, why? Well, that's it. Just last week, after an article appeared online about the tomatoes that we're working on, we had 600 requests. So the people in the lab are spending all their time counting out 20 seeds and putting them in envelopes now instead of doing research, but it's a really good thing. It's a really good thing. So just to conclude, we made really significant progress in the breeder's toolkit. We know what the targets are. We've identified a lot of the genes. We haven't even begun to start thinking about stacking genes that influence the same pathways, but we have a lot of tools that are available to us to improve the commercial germplasm. It just needs to be done. It's expensive science, and probably it's going to have to be done by industry. We're going to need industry support to get it done right and get it done quickly. But we're making as much progress as we can with what we have available to us. Unexpected bonuses. This thing about the sweet enhancing volatiles is really exciting. If you think about it, it has tremendous potential for the entire food industry. To be able to remove sugar and replace it with volatile chemicals that have very little caloric content has tremendous opportunity. It's already potentially, as Liz and Thomas, who are sitting right in front of her, knows, the citrus industry, the problem with citrus greening. There's a huge opportunity there to make orange juice taste better. But finally, the home garden market. I think we have the potential to actually change the home garden market as well. And we're working. The publicity that we've gotten has been really good. We've been contacted by a number of small growers who are targeting niches, you know, high-end supermarkets, restaurants, who are very, we've already sent them seeds to grow. You know, we're, until the seed companies come around, we're gonna drive this by pulling by the consumers. And we think that, that the response we've got says it'll happen. And finally, I just want to wrap it up by saying one thing, and that is, this was the paradigm. This was the blueprint for how we want to do breeding. It's being now applied to other crops that the University of Florida has significant germplasm in, but we think that this is how we're going to give people what they want. And we think it should be an integral part of any breeding program. Just the same way that you select for disease resistances, you should be asking the consumer what they think about it. So finally, let me acknowledge a few people. Let me start at the bottom with Liz. Again, Liz was really essential in the early stages, really convinced us that this was a project worth working on, and did some really pioneering work on the effects of volatiles, particularly on chilling, which I suspect someone will ask about. Howard Moskowitz is a really interesting guy. Google him sometime if you really want to see something interesting. He's developed a lot of the techniques for consumer testing that we use, and very powerful techniques. Jim and Faye are two USDA scientists at Cornell. Again, I've had a collaboration with Jim for a dozen years. Linda, I've mentioned, Dave, and also Charlie Sims, the food scientist, and the people in my lab on the top who do really all the work, except the crosses. I do all the crosses. So, anyway, let me stop there.
Terry, you want to take a couple of questions?
Oh, sure.
Got time for a few. Let's start over here.
We should go into that separately. We could talk about that. It's complicated, as you can imagine. Only because we just don't have a lot of time here. Yeah.
You mentioned you also do blueberries. Well, there's 5-10-fold difference in sugars in most of the fruits that have a lot of similar volatile pathways and important esters, etc. So how does that sugar perception in a fruit that has so much more sugar relate to those two lines in the tomato?
Thomas, do you want to answer that?
I'll be talking about that on Friday.
So it turns out, just to summarize, without stealing Thomas's story, we've looked at strawberries, we've looked at blueberries. What, we looked at any others yet?
Peach, yeah. Orange, a little bit of cherry.
Yeah, orange for sure, yeah. So it turns out that each fruit seems to have a subset of volatiles that contribute to sweetness. So the answer is there are volatiles in all of these fruits, and they're not the same ones. And that, again, probably comes back to maybe it's a learned behavior. But there are volatiles in blueberry that do enhance the perception of sweetness, and I've set up Thomas.
Thank you, sir.
I've noticed that when I eat a cherry tomato in the winter compared to an ordinary supermarket tomato, the cherry tomatoes always taste better.
Yeah.
Because they're smaller and more sugar, or they have more volatiles?
They definitely have more sugar, and they definitely have more volatiles. And, you know, I think they've not been as intensively bred as the big tomatoes. But I think the big thing here is that there's an inverse correlation between sugar content and fruit size. Tomato is a this is great. I can say this in an audience that'll actually understand it. Tomato is a source limiting crop, and so what happens is that basically what's been selected for over the last 50 years with the large beef tomatoes, the field round tomatoes, is that we've exceeded the capacity of the plant to fill it with photosynthate, and you end up with water. So basically what you've done is you've diluted out the flavor compounds. We know that one of our alleles that came out of the GWAS study is a sugar gene that maps right on top of a fruit weight gene. We suspect that they're one and the same, that the bigger fruit weight leads to lower sugar.
So while a small increase in volatiles might not induce a yield drag, are there any other examples in tomatoes of engineered tomatoes negative epistatic interactions within the genome?
Well, that gets into a whole complicated area. The genome sequences of a lot of the tomato varieties indicate that a lot of the disease resistance that's been introduced over the last few years, well, the last several decades, very large chunks of wild relative have come along with them. In some cases, half of the chromosome is derived from the wild relatives. That can't help but have a negative impact on quality, flavor quality. Of course, it gives you resistance, but and better yield. But yes, there probably is. We're still. Our collaborator San Nguyen is working to understand the complications of domestication, and there clearly are a lot of them, and I think we're just beginning to understand them.
Where in the tomato is flavor found?
Ah, good question. So Jay Scott, a number of years ago, said, well, I think that it's in the locular tissue, that the locule has more flavor than the pericarp. We were pretty skeptical, but actually we've done some follow-up studies, and on a weight basis, there probably are more volatiles in the gel than there are in the pericarp. So of course, what have they selected for? They've selected for more pericarp, less gel, because they ship better. There are many reasons why the modern tomato doesn't taste great, but that's one of them. There's also the uniform gene, which is another story altogether, which reduces the level of sugar but gives you a tomato that ripens more uniformly. Tomatoes that there are more volatiles in the gel in my opinion with the varieties that we have looked at, which is a very few.
Yeah, you mentioned the fact that the lower sugar content, which actually should increase yield. However, mm-hmm. I'm wondering also, I would guess that the sugar levels, brick levels, will also affect texture. So I don't think it's quite as simple.
Texture is really complicated. Yeah, well, I don't understand it, so it must be complicated, right? No, I don't mean that. So sucrose is broken down to glucose and fructose during ripening in tomato. There's no sucrose left in the fruit. I would say that the things that affect the texture in the tomato are probably not related directly to at least glucose and fructose. We know texture can be a problem. What we found, and actually this confused us for a while, when we were doing the chemical correlations with predicting how much people would like a tomato, we saw outliers. We saw like 15% of the tomatoes were just way off from what we thought they would be. It turns out many of those were textural issues. In many cases, they were too soft, too mealy. We really don't understand mealiness. We know what it is, and we can measure it, but we don't understand why. So there are textural issues that are unrelated to glucose and fructose, but texture clearly is very important. I'm not sure I answered your question.
Yeah, well, I said probably texture is not a good word. Certainly the sugars would expect to be in the vacuole, so it would affect the sugar pressure.
Most of the problems we see, the biggest problem by far is mealiness. And that's just a case of holding the cells together. In the mealy tomatoes, the cells don't break and they just kind of pop apart. So that's not necessarily directly related to sugar content.
I'm going to take one more question right here.
So have you think or look at the relationship of your flavor and the shelf life?
No. We have not. We're really, really focused on relying on breeders like Sam to provide us with material that has those kinds of qualities. What we're really specifically trying to do is focus on someone else's elite germplasm that has the best shelf life and up the levels of the chemicals that we know. And I should say there are a few that we actually want to bring down. There are some off flavors that we want to get rid of. So there's no reason to suspect that these chemicals will affect shelf life, but we're always concerned that we're dealing with chemicals that are there for some other purpose besides flavor. These chemicals were not made by the fruit just to taste good initially. They're probably involved in plant pathogen interactions, plant insect interactions. We do have to be very careful. What I come back and tell people is we are only working within the range of what already exists in the species. We're not trying to make new things that are outside the range of the existing germplasm.
I look around the room here and I realize that just about everybody in this room goes to a lot of presentations, science presentations, things on agricultural topics. And you know when you've seen a really good one. And I think we've just seen an outstanding presentation here. It's obvious to me, Dr. Klee, why you were selected for this.
Thank you. I think
Morrison would be delighted, and I think we are as well. So thank you very much.
The Agricultural Research Service has struck a medal in honor of this presentation and this award, and I want to present that to Dr. Klee now. As soon as we're finished, I think we have a little bit of a reception set up right outside the back door, but I want to go ahead and make this presentation. Is Kim Kaplan around? She's out there with the camera. I think she wanted to. We'll go ahead and present, and then we'll get a photograph later. That way everybody doesn't have to just sit around. So it's my great pleasure to present to you Harry Klee, the 2015 Benjamin Y. Morrison Memorial Lecture Award. Thank you very much.
Thank you.